I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source under the open West Indian sun at the Calabash Literary Festival at Treasure Beach, Jamaica. We call Open Source an American conversation with global attitude. This time we're listening in over a long May weekend to Caribbean perspectives on life and letters, and most especially on the presidential campaign and the Obama moment in American politics, in which far corners of the world feel an interest and a stake. This first dispatch from Calabash is the poet Derek Walcott's version of things. It includes his reading of a scandalous new poem, nasty by his own description, titled The Mongoose, in which Walcott, the first Caribbean winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, mocks and mauls the second Nobel medalist, his one-time friend from Trinidad, the novelist and essayist V.S. Naipaul. Their clash is now bigger than just their egos. It involves Walcott's devotion to and Naipaul's disdain for the West Indies. Walcott's ancestral roots in Africa, Naipaul's in India have something to do with it. But it's an argument about where lasting art comes from and where it lives. Derek Walcott had top billing at this three-day Calabash festival. He saved his mongoose attack on Naipaul as a surprise at the end of a 40-minute reading and interview. The two founders of the annual Calabash festival introduced Walcott, first the reggae novelist Colin Channer, and then the poet Kwame Dawes.
How are you doing, Calabash? All right, all right. There's one thing that Jamaicans revere. We like intelligent people. We especially like intelligent people who can ground with a common man. Yeah? We love a man who write things about us that make us see we in a different light. That's why we love Bob Marley, and that's why we love Peter Tosh, and that's why we love the author who will be speaking with Kwame Dawes today. Them man, they write about we, like we are the center of the world, and we are. So, there are some people who need no introduction, and he's one of them. His name is Derek Walcott. But he's going to be speaking with Kwame Dawes. Can we have a round of applause, please, for Mr. Dawes?
All right, Calabash, this is exciting. It is a great honor, Derek, for me to be talking to you. And I thought I would start off by asking you about your experience with Jamaica. You have a long history with Jamaica. And so what are your thoughts every time you land in Jamaica? What are some of your first thoughts?
I have to go through customs.
Has that always been traumatic?
You know. No, when I stay in Jamaica any length of time, I remember John Hearn very much. Mm-hmm. Very close friend. And I think what has happened over the years is that what happens with a good writer is that the landscape starts to look like the prose. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it feels John Hearnian, like even this morning.
Right, so right.
That's what I feel. Because I loved him dearly, and he's gone, but his work is here.
Yeah, yeah. And Calabash would remember that we did feature John Hearn's Voices Under the Window as a celebration of his work and so on. You know, I'm asking you another Jamaican-related question. There is a BBC, you did a program on the BBC some years ago. I think it's called Desert Island Discs. And that was some years ago. But I remember you're listing the songs and the music that you would like to take on a desert island. And if I recall rightly, you had two reggae songs on that, two Bob Marley songs on that. I think you had No Woman No Cry as one of them. And I think you had Redemption Song as one of them.
You showed us two. I thought it was only one. No, that was before Bob Marley became, you know, elite.
Mm-hmm.
So the song, the lyrics for that are so terrific.
Yeah.
That's why I said it. But I told some people that. I think I didn't know what I was doing. I thought I was just doing a radio program. But when I told people I was on Desert Island Discs, they nearly fell down. They said, "You were on Desert Island Discs?" I said, "Yeah, it's just a radio program."
Yeah.
Said, "No,
yeah,
more than that." But I remember playing Bob Marley.
Yeah,
it wasn't wildly popular then.
No, this was when it was not hip to celebrate Bob Marley.
Yeah.
And I remember you talked a lot about the lyric, about the simplicity of the lyric and the capacity to capture the experience of people with that lyric. So
there's some writers of lyrics for songs that you think approach poetry, but need music to go with it.
Right.
But some of the lines that I quoted from Marley on that program, well, he is genuinely a poet.
Yeah.
You know, who wrote music.
Yeah. Yeah. That's also a good thing to say here at Calabash. if you were to do it now, I mean, maybe nowadays you'd be like Buju Banton and Bounty Killer. Maybe it would be like Elephant Man.
No. I don't know. I know you Jamaicans think that everybody keeps up with their music, but that's not necessarily true.
I'm
I think I'll leave now.
Yeah. You are doing so well, Derek.
No, if I'm likely to, I'm in the Southern Caribbean, and if I'm likely to quote a popular music, it might more be calypso than it might be reggae, maybe.
Yeah. The other question I had, which is related to popular culture, is one of the things that I don't think it's as well known about you as your fascination with film, that you've been interested in film for years. When you look at film today, where is your sort of strong interest in film? What kinds of films really capture your imagination and engage you?
Well, I think ultimately, but not in my time, I think film will become very accessible. I think it's accessible now, but they're not selling it. Mm. I mean, I think they're hiding the technology.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, and I think every poet would want to make a film much more than he might or she might want to write a novel, for
That's
instance.
Interesting,
because
yeah.
this immediacy of that is film is a visual, metrical kind of art, and it's closer, I think, to poetry than even to fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So, but of course, the thing about film is that it costs a fortune.
Right, to make it, yeah.
I think what will happen is that, in fact, the films that people go to now are not necessarily the big, you know, Indiana Jones thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But they still go.
Mm-hmm.
I go. Mm. And that's a medium that I think is going to happen. It's a natural Caribbean medium, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what about it? The statement you made, which is that film is closer to poetry than fiction. Can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, why would you say that?
Well, the camera cannot do metaphor.
Right.
It can do similar because it works frame by frame. Mm-hmm. So you cannot transform objects into something else, which you can in poetry.
Right.
But because of the training and the habit of thinking in metaphor, then simile is like an apprenticeship to metaphor, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And since nearly every poet has the access and the ability to think in simile, by the time they get to metaphor, they can do something with film that people who think of film as narrative, as a prosaic thing, don't work with the instinctual possibility for error that can happen in film. Film is like accident. Good films are like accidents. Things that happen can't be predicted. They don't say, this is going to happen now.
Right.
In some great directors, yes. But generally, the instinct in film is the instinct of accident.
Mm.
And the instinct of accident that's there in a poem, very parallel to that of a film. What tends to happen is, in the adaptation of, say, a well-known novel, the compression that you do in telling narrative and to reduce narrative to images, which is what you have to do, is the same technique as editing a poem, in a way. So I think that there's a great future for Caribbean film, because we have excellent, very excellent writers, and the natural sequence of this is in film.
Would you, so is the I mean, it really makes me think about the issue of how talent operates, you know, talent for film, talent for poetry, and so on. I mean, how crucial is talent for the idea of talent? And I'm not even sure how to define that word talent. But how crucial is talent to a writer's success, for instance? The idea of talent. I mean, you started as a young writer, but is talent something you can identify at a young age, or is talent that important, or is there something else that drives success as a writer?
Are we still with film?
No, we've moved to writing now.
Writing.
To poetry.
I'd still stay on film a little in that.
All right, we can stay.
The cliche is that the Caribbean has rhythms.
Right.
It's not a cliche, but it's so true and it's so obvious that it's a cliche. Whether it's Latin America or whether it's Caribbean or Central America, the basis and beat of all those art forms are basically rhythmic, very rhythmic. And the rhythm, of course, is African. I don't want to do one of these, you know, waving flags or race and so on, but that's the instinct of what we have. And I think that that relates very strongly to the fact that the music that we speak is very... it's a language. We have a language for the music that we write, and we think simultaneously, I think, in both words and music.
Right.
So you have a lot of people who, we don't divide ourselves into, say, composer, lyricist. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of, don't you write music yourself?
I do, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So this instinct of, you know, crystallizing two forms into one, right, is a very Caribbean thing.
Right. But when you worked in theater, I mean, you work in theater and you've done musicals. Have you done the music or you've done the lyric?
No, I didn't do the music. I've worked with some terrific composers.
Right.
I've worked with Gordon McDermott. I've worked with Andre Tanker. Mm-hmm. I've worked with Paul Simon, and so on. So they work in different ways. Paul Simon is, of course, a terrific poet himself and a terrific composer. Gordon will take a lyric that I have written, and without changing the words, to find the music to fit the words.
Right.
And that is, I think, remarkable. Andre used to write his own lyrics, his own songs, too. But he also, we didn't work too long on one song, one play called Tijan and His Brothers. But working with the with these composers, again, these are people with a very strong sense of rhythm. Mm-hmm. I mean, Paul Simon is, you know, very rhythm-driven.
Right.
So is Gold, and so obviously Andre.
Yeah. Did Paul Simon mess with your lyrics?
Huh?
Did Paul Simon mess around with your lyrics more than...
No, he didn't. No, we worked together sometimes, and I just said, stop messing with my lyrics. No. No. He's a great composer. He's a terrific lyric writer.
Yeah.
But modest about his, you know, in terms of what he thinks he has done. But the lyrics for some of the songs are wonderful, you know. And I watched him work on some songs. We did a musical together, and at one point I said, you know, we need a song like Graceland Now.
Right.
And he wrote a terrific song, but basically, you know, rhythm, very rhythm-driven.
Right.
I prefer him as a composer to Dylan.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, and he references you significantly on The Coast, that CD, The Coast.
Yeah.
And you can see his, I mean, he has stretches of that, passages of that, beautiful poet, but you can see the echoes of your work running through that as well. That show has been revived, hasn't it? Or it's been...
They just did a terrific concert in BAM.
Yeah.
Of a concert of the Cape Man.
Right, yeah. I like that. There's some, and you did most of the lyrics on.
No.
You did.
Paul is a very good writer.
No question.
But I'm a better musician.
You're a better musician. I want to move on to another area of a sort of additional artistic interest that you have, which is painting, and as many of you know, I think nowadays virtually every one of your covers is one of your one of your paintings and so on. And I, from my understanding of your own biography, you were painting sort of earnestly even before you were seriously writing poetry. Is that, would that be accurate?
Who's Ernest Lee? Is that a Chinese guy?
Yeah, he's a Chinese guy. He's actually Trinidadian.
My father, who I didn't know, he died when I was one. My brother, Helen, was a twin. Mm-hmm. Was a painter to a very good watercolorist. And my mother understood what we wanted to do very easily because her husband was a painter and a writer too. Mm-hmm. So that I was completely encouraged by her. Mm-hmm. I was also encouraged by a painter called Harold Simmons, right, who was a painter. And we used to use his studio. So, I mean, there's nothing better for a young writer or a young painter to have someone who takes his or her work seriously. Mm-hmm. I had the blessing of that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I had great teachers. My mother was a teacher. And I think what I've tried to do, part of the work that I do is teaching, and I enjoy mm-hmm. working with young poets mm-hmm. a great deal. Mm-hmm. Painting, I'm a square in terms of painting. I hate abstract expressionism. I hate a lot of things.
You hate to even look at it?
Yes, I cannot stand it.
Okay. All right, that's
fair. Which is nonsense, because there are some great abstract expressionists, I think. Hmm. I just think it's very hard in art to do what is, to get what is there.
Just
right.
That alone, right.
Well, yeah. Not alone, it's everything.
But it's everything, yeah.
Because I think some arts leave out aspects of the other arts. I think there are a lot of painters who leave out the fact that we yearn for meaning mm-hmm. and who think, especially in America, meaning is passé, you know, mm-hmm. or syntax is passé, certainly rhyme is passé. Mm-hmm. And you have to fight that a lot in America because America's dictum is everything has to be new.
Right.
And everything is based on psychology rather than aesthetics. Mm-hmm. So that the natural direction of any actor is towards a nervous breakdown.
Mm-hmm. So then painting then becomes sort of the kind of work you do. It's called representational, but how does one then in those kinds of paintings, does one look for the emotional elements in there?
There's a very dangerous thing that can happen, that is happening in the mm-hmm. Caribbean. And that is we are dictated to still mm-hmm. by what used to be the empires.
Right.
The new American empire is the empire. Mm-hmm. It's the world empire. Mm-hmm. And whatever the tastes of the empire, they are inflicted on the colonies of that empire. So we are intellectual colonies of America, mm-hmm. and so is a lot of the world. Mm-hmm. So that if people say in America now, which they do, that painting is finished and now what you have is installation or right. some other thing, then the young Caribbean artist mm-hmm. feels that he's out of it if he doesn't or she doesn't mm-hmm. do what the empire thinks mm-hmm. is fashionable. Mm-hmm. And what the empire thinks is fashionable or unfashionable is that you don't tell stories, you don't mold character, you don't have a middle, a beginning, and an end. That's old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. Well, it is a great thing that Caribbean art is old-fashioned because we still tell stories, mm-hmm. which is what the human heart craves, mm-hmm. you know, and we still have a culture that speaks directly to its people in terms of song and the lyrics of songs. Mm-hmm. There aren't many cultures around that still do that.
Right.
If how many, I don't know, how many people in Germany sing a German folk song, you know?
Right. And has your work been about resisting that kind of colonial and imperialist influence in that particular sense?
Are you using these words easily or you mean that?
Notice I said in that particular sense. Because I know that could be a great opportunity for some big statement by Derek Walcott about imperialism and colonialism.
No.
But I mean, do you find yourself consciously resisting that inclination, that whether it's the inclination towards the
abstract? I think a parallel would be, let's say two things, right? If you're teaching tennis, I don't play tennis, I don't play anything. But if you're teaching a young tennis player how to, whatever you're doing, serve or something, and you tell him or her, you put your foot here, and you do your hand this, and you do that stroke, that's the same thing virtually as telling a young writer, this is a good idea to take this beat here and so on. Now, it isn't that every tennis player is the same, or that every young apprentice player does the same thing. But inevitably you wind up at something that cannot be altered, and that is form, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that if you decide to go out on your own, you see, there's an urgency in America to make it new, to get famous.
Right.
And you can get very famous in America and make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
When Rent came out, I thought, Rent, who wants to see a thing called Rent? 10 years later, the author is dead, the composer is dead, but he's a multimillionaire.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the danger there is to think in terms of being a multimillionaire in any of the forms, including painting, because there's some terrible painters who make millions of dollars in the States because they're so terrible. They get a lot of money for that. So we have a very, very difficult life here in terms of choosing a balance that is not affected or that is not too provincial, or that is not too rootsy or too something, you know, and the individual conscience and individual gift has to choose where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a very healthy condition that we're in now still. Your generation of writers are very good. Mm-hmm. They have learned, they're not just belligerently Caribbean, you know, or black or Indian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a balance now being struck that I'm very happy to see, you know?
But part of that, and I'm glad you bring it up in that way, but part of that is we have, and I've said this many times, we had, whether it's you or Brathwaite or whoever it is, establishing something that we could call tradition, at least the beginnings of tradition. You did not necessarily have that experience as a writer when you started. I mean, and tradition in sometimes superficial sense, but actually in an emotional sense, to say somebody who comes from this space and writes about this space has done it and done it as well, and therefore it gives you a sense of possibility. But where did you find the sense of possibility as a writer who is writing new this Caribbean landscape?
The answer is not, the answer lies in melody.
Mm-hmm.
If your vocal melody is true to your own character, you're okay.
Mm.
You don't have to break out into dialect or nation thing or some kind of bad heavy talk, whatever kind of name, if your melody is right. So it's not a matter of one melody being better than the other.
Right?
The rhythm that you speak in is the rhythm you write in. The rhythm you and I speak in is a common rhythm, right? We may write differently, but what we have at the basis of our, I don't even want to say culture, because I'm tired of the word culture, especially now. If it's true, and it's very hard to be true, it takes you a long time. I think maybe for any artist, it takes your lifetime to write something ultimately that is your own melody, that is not, you know, mixed or corrupted or influenced, very heavily influenced by, you know, by other things.
Mm-hmm.
But a culture grows like that. I mean, American culture, according to, you know, Hemingway about Mark Twain, American culture didn't really happen until Mark Twain wrote American.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty is that Mark Twain didn't write bad grammar to be American, right? Huck Finn spoke a certain way, but I think the wrong thing to do is to feel that you have to fix up your own grammar, you have to mash up what is there before, and so on, whereas what you should do is accommodate that. What we have to be in the Caribbean is sponges. We have to absorb all the cultures into one, and not to isolate one particularly.
And through that mechanism, writers find their voice, and then something emerges.
Yeah, and I think the Caribbean literature has just begun, really. I think it's just scraping the beginning.
That's interesting. in
that makes you feel good because you're younger.
Yes, absolutely. Because you're absolutely talking about me. It's just bigger. I think it's Prodigal. You intimated that you're pretty much done with writing poetry. Is that true?
That's a good sympathy. If you say this, if you keep saying it's your last book, no, please. Keep writing.
Come, please, Derek. Oh, another one, please. Yeah. Another one. But does it, I'll say this, that I think this is true. Others have said it, so I'm not saying anything particularly unique.
That I should stop.
No, on the contrary. On the contrary, people have said that, you know, typically people say, you know, the writer does their best work in the first, you know, the early part of their career, and that's when you know, and then it's downhill after that. And there are some good examples to prove that. But a number of critics have sort of said that the distinction that you have is, every time you bring a new book out, you challenge that notion, that there's a sense in which you're still enthusiastic about pushing form, pushing what you have to say, and so on. Do you feel that way? I mean, is the thing you're doing now, the exciting thing now, the thing that you think you're going to make really work?
I'm 78, right? I never thought I'd get here. Mm. I thought I was going to die at 30.
Yeah. That's right.
I saw everything. I saw the gravestone. I saw people coming to visit it. I saw the little brackets of my name. Died at 25. Oh, my God. 50 years later, I'm still here.
Still here.
What am I hanging out for? Anyway, I think I'm going to be reading some stuff that I say to myself, this is very simple. This is very ordinary. Mm. And I think I am delighting in that, not from some sense of resignation about anything. I just don't like it now when any art makes a fuss. Mm. I don't like over-agitated poetry because I know the technique. I know what people are doing. I know they're going to be very bright. I don't want to be bright. I don't want to be intimidated when I read a poem or challenged or grabbed by the collar. I just want them to leave me alone, please. Let me read the poem in peace. You know? And so I have come to a point where even if it appears to be resignation and repetition, I don't care, as long as it's clear and as long as what I'm saying is at least honest emotionally, mm-hmm. that I'm very irritated about style. I'm irritated about style in painting, style in music, style in, you know, because style is a way of attracting attention mm-hmm. to the creator of the thing, mm-hmm. right? What we want to be is we want to be anonymous and transparent, ultimately, mm-hmm. I think. Now, there can be a very high transparency. Dante is transparent. Mm-hmm. You don't look at Dante's writing. You just have the poetry, and it's like looking through glass, mm-hmm. you know, and it's making glass is difficult. Mm-hmm. So you look through the poem like a glass pane into the source of the poem. You don't look at Dante's psychology. Mm-hmm. That's the last thing he'd want. But this is an age in which, you know, everything is based on character, the analysis of character. So the more interesting you make your own character, the more interesting you can become,
right?
So nobody strives for anonymity. That's almost a contradiction. But that is what art strives for. Hmm. Strives at.
And for you, that is your current kind of the work that you're moving towards.
Yeah, I would like to evaporate in front of the poem.
Okay. Well, I think on that note,
what are you gonna do?
You're gonna evaporate right now. But what we hope to do is to have a time to talk with Derek, and then he's going to do some reading for us. And I think that's a great segue for Derek Walker to read some of his work to us. But Derek, I have to say that it is a great pleasure that you would come to talk to us and to read here at Calabash. You see what we do here. And we've always said from the beginning, Derek Walker has to come to Calabash at some point. And we're grateful. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's listen to Derek Walcott as he reads his work.
What, you're going to be Superman at 77? Got your weight down? Okay, you've lost 7 pounds. But what you've also lost is belief in heaven as dear friends die. Still making his rounds, the postman, the scyther, Basil, whatever you call him, a cyclist silently exercising on Sunday down a striped avenue of Casarinas with bursts of foam on the breakwater's wall. I'm sure everyone knows it'll happen one day, the yachts nodding agreement in all the marinas, the blackbirds in frock coats, the frogs staccato hymn. 7 less pounds and you'll need a slimmer coffin. You suffer from a furious itch that raises welts on your neck and forearms. So now that you swim early in the morning to avoid the sun, fear melts before daybreak's beauty, despite all that coughing. You really don't have to. I'll worry. The acacia trees. You used to be able to drive, though I don't, across the wide pool-sheeted pasture below the house to the hot, empty beach and park in the starved shade of the acacias that print those tiny yellow flowers. Blank, printless beaches are part of my trade. Then there were men with tapes and theodolites who measured the wild, uneven ground. I watched the doomed acres where yet another luxury hotel will be built with ordinary people fenced out. The new makers of our history profit without guilt and are, in fact, prophets of a policy that will make the island a mall, and the breakers grin like waiters, like taxi drivers. These new plantations by the sea, a slavery without chains, with no blood spilt, just chain link fences and signs, the new degradations. I felt such freedom writing. Okay, you finish it. I felt such freedom writing under the acacias, and sometimes just to keep the popularity in, you got to break down into dialect, even if you don't mean it. I mean it. Boss man, if you look in those bush there, you'll find a whole set of passport, wallet, ID, credit card. That is no use to them. It's cash on their mind. And it's not every time you'll find them afterwards. You just leave your bag with these things on the sand, and faster than wind, they jump out of the bush while you're there swimming and rubbing tanning lotion. And when you find out, it's no use to send the special unit. They don't reach Masad. But I, not in that, not me. I just make a little change selling and blowing conch shell. It's sad, but it's true. Them faster than any vehicle. And I self never get in any commotion except the waves. And soon, all that will be lost. It's too much tourists and too little employment. How about a little life there? Thanks, but boss, don't let what I say spoil your enjoyment. This is an elegy for someone who died too young, August Wilson. Probably the greatest American playwright in our time. August, the quarter moon hangs like a bugle over the old brick cantonments of the morn, whose barrack apartments have the serial glow of postage stamps. The clouds' letters are torn, and your sweet instrument is put away as your silver cornet lies in its velvet case, with all those riffs and arias whose characters argue the way that wind elates the acacias, until they wrestle with the roar of torrents. Black, jagged silhouettes ready to do battle with enormous hands and eyes with the coming day in the brick thickets of Pittsburgh and Seattle, in plays that are their own battle cry and anthem. I unhook the quarter moon to blow your praise, and Horace Pippin, Romare, Joseph Lawrence. I saw the moon hanging there and thought of them. quick, before they all die. The hard ebony head of Arthur Jacobs, the bare pate, the broken teeth that make his grin more powerful. A man with no money despite his tremendous presence, as light as a leaf and a delicate dancer, coal black and like coal, packed with inspiring fire. A diamond with his memory fading. Jesus, the beauty he contains, a beauty of soul no less than a wit and intelligence the degrading indifference he has had to endure. Some of the best already gone, Wilbert Holder, Claude Reed, Ermine Wright, against the wind. For a long time, they kept a steady flame of devotion. They had to do what was right for their calling against their most polished detractors, like those who claim they cannot be black and actors. I mean minds like Naipaul's, who find a contradiction in their passion and sacrifice, but whom I cherish more than the most overpriced fiction. I must clear the house of my head. I must make room for a shrine before they all die with fireflies and starlight. And this is the last one. I debated whether to read this here for the first time in public. The others are new too. And I figured if I don't do it, I'll say, what the hell, you should have done it. The Mongoose. I think you recognize Mr. Naipaul. Going to be nasty. I have been bitten. I must avoid infection, or else I'll be as dead as Naipaul's fiction. Read his last novels, you'll see just what I mean. A lethargy approaching the obscene. The model is more ho-hum than Dickens. The essays have more bite. They scatter chickens like critics, but each stabbing phrase is poison, since he has made that snaring style a prison. Their plots are forced, the prose sedate and silly. The anti-hero is a prick named Willie, who lacks the conflict of a war or Lawrence and whines with his creator's self-abhorrence. They are exhausted works, respectful reading, incestuous repetition and inbreeding. So the old mongoose, still making good money, is a burnt-out comic, predictable, unfunny. The joy of supplements, his minstrel act, delighting editors, endorsing facts over fiction, tearing colleagues and betters to pieces in the name of English letters. The feathers fly, their snow comes drifting down. The mongoose keeps its class act as a clown. It can do cartwheels of exaggeration. Mostly it snivels, proud of being Asian, or of being attached to nothing, race or nation. It would be just as if a corpse took pride in its decay after its gift had died, and off the page its bile exude the stench of envy, la pourriture in French. Cursed its first breath from being Trinidadian, then wrote the same piece for the English Guardian. Once he liked humans, how long ago this was, the mongoose wrote A House for Mr. Biswas. Now what sustains a rodent in old age are fees for rooting in upended garbage, peeled skins of gossip, apple cores, scraped, half-bitten toast, old rice, chewed anecdotes. Look at the photograph and analyze the vicious merriment in a writer's eyes. Small, gray, and beady-eyed, a bushy beard to cover features that have always snared. To show its kindness, it clutches a kitten that looks as if it's scared of being bitten. Right at the neck, it's the mongoose's nature. It cannot help that it was born in Asia and climbed to club and gatehouse with good manners to squirearchy from the cane fields of Chaguanas. But please, no more of being a true Brahmin to a resounding Presbyterian Amin. Because those fields at dawn, at every hour, increase with light their adjectival power, are beautiful, though not to him, unblessed by history. Old mongoose, take a rest. Imported from India and trained to ferret snakes and elude Africans, the mongoose takes its orders from the Raj. I look to the hills are wonderful, even when the Karani fills with Gangetic mud and prayer flags flutter in the light of the windy plain, even to the mutter of a maniacal bitter mongoose under the lion house, and so it goes. I thought once that all the mongoose needed for greatness was compassion. If it had heeded the gaping wound from all the blades he hated, and so his name was one I nominated for the laurel branch. For 5 years he waited. India and England were in his citation of gratitude, but not the negroid nation that nursed his gift. Perhaps with milk gone sour, to curse the helpless with your gift is power perverted tyrants use. Accent and diction reward them with the spit of benediction. I'm in my anecdotage too, so listen. Perhaps you'll smile, perhaps your ducks will glisten. The mongoose came home to the Canes. He wanted us to go to Club Miramar, a dingy nightclub on the Port of Spain waterfront. Screwing negresses is part of his memoir. He doesn't like black men, but he loves black cunt. This is a common fact in his late fiction. He told me once he thought sex was just friction. He had a cap from Egypt. He told a whore he couldn't give her the cap. Maybe more money. I didn't go. The mongoose is a funny chap, quite funny. She said, "You went quite Egypt and you can't give me a cap?" Switch to Stockholm. I'm coming to the end. Don't worry, the mongoose is not a friend. He won the prize. Now it was time to bite whatever hands had helped him. He was right. In all the spangled ceremony of Stockholm, the liveried servants, the blaring orchestra, he turned to greet me again with renewed extra delight as if I were a friend, a privilege I wouldn't dare now with this Brahmin sage. "Derek," he said, "not Derek." And our home flashed in one shared instant. Hills, sea, sugarcane, Chaguanas, Couva, Carony, even Port of Spain. Where a navel spring buried is a wise saying, and that is what I saw in eyes chafing with weariness, if not remorse. Let rise and help Hyperion to his horse. I've always loved that phrase, and it applies to everything. The sun touches like great verse. I look to the hills are wonderful. The rivers run to the sea. The Carony is full of its Gangetic mud. Far off, the mongoose raves, and time draws close with its slow, judging waves. Thank you.
Derek Walcott, ladies and gentlemen.